don't you help myself? I'm with you too.
You feel very left out.
To think that he's about to have.
I think you picked this
I want you to know, I'm the guy who tweeted, I hate Jim Wirt. He shows the audience all sorts of cool stuff.
I mean,
that's true.
You know?
We'll play it for you.
We didn't get picked in Jim.
So, no, it doesn't start soon. It starts now. Star Wars versus Lord of the Rings. Welcome. That's right, it is. Westeros was yesterday. So, yeah. So, welcome. Welcome to the Tolkien Track. We're going to do this panel twice today, so if you like it and you want to come back and see it again, I'm sure our panelists will probably end up talking about different things, and we'll be in a bigger room.
I'll be very different.
Upstairs, yeah.
I'll be totally
you'll look,
tonight.
You'll
I'll look
bearded
like Larry Gerdes.
So, we figured that given the Star Wars year coming up, we don't have a Middle Earth movie coming in December, but we do have a Star Wars movie. And some of us actually have our fingers crossed that it's not like episodes 1 through 3.
Yeah. Phantom Menace was the best, man.
That's right. Okay, so already we've got controversy.
Leave now. I'll never come back.
Sure, leave now. So let me introduce our panelists to you today, if you can see them. Sorry, it's the room they gave us, so we'll try to wave at you. We've got pictures and stuff. Mostly, we're going to hear from our panelists. Kirsten Cairns. Recently removed to the United Kingdom, but back for Dragon Con again, is a long-term Dragon Con loyalist, member of the OneRing.net staff. Go down and see their booth over in the Hyatt. So you can get all kinds of cool stuff there. And Kirsten speaks in a British accent, which makes everything sound brilliant.
Yeah, British.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. On the other end is Michael Martinez. If any of you are in the blogosphere, in the Middle Earth space, you have run into Michael, especially if you're asking deep questions and want interesting insights on lots of things Middle Earthian and Tolkien-esque. But he's also watched Star Wars, so he's here to join us.
Jar Jar Binks forever, baby.
It's Star Wars. Star Wars, not that.
Mason thinks you like him.
As you can tell, Michael is a bit of a contrarian. He's a great guy to have on a panel. Valdis Longbeard is from Middle Earth News, another fine website that highlights many Middle Earthian and Tolkien things. And so she's back for the second year. This is her second Dragon Con. And back on panel. Welcome. Constance Wagner is another one of our resident scholars and a long-term member of many panels. She's got several. She's got one more left coming up later today on explaining what really happened at Mount Doom. So come back and see Constance on that.
4 o'clock.
4 o'clock. And Dragon Con has helped her to continue advancing in her writing work. So thank you for coming. Keep at Constance and tell her to finish the book.
Hopefully by the end of this coming year or so.
Our other scholar and an author, and you can tell he's a scholar and because he's wearing a tie.
Bad habit.
That's right. So he brings dignity to the panel, along with great insight. So Greg Wilson's an author and a scholar and is joining us on the panel. So welcome to our panelists. And the street hook nerdist host. Okay. So here's what we're trying to cover today. Not everything. It's just an hour. So come back. We have another hour at 8:30 tonight. We're not trying to do death matchups, although if you provoke us, and I threw a few in there, just in case. We probably won't do those, but we'll see if we can do. But we picked five themes. We're kind of doing a little sample across the Star Wars and the Middle Earth universe. And trying to find some common elements, things that we can compare and contrast in these fantasy and science fiction worlds. And one of those is heroes. In fact, heroes that start as reluctant heroes. And that's the theme of Constance Wagner's book. So she's going to cover reluctant heroes. Second is fall and redemption. In fact, one of the great story arcs in all of Star Wars is the Anakin Skywalker storyline. But there are also very redemptive storylines in The Lord of the Rings, people like Boromir or even Gollum. Mm-hmm. And so Greg is going to handle that component and kick us off there. Destiny and free will.
Use the Force.
It's your density.
It is your destiny. Yeah. So, but there's also a lot of providence, of, you know, sometimes they call it luck, or some sort of a guiding hand that's going on in The Lord of the Rings as well. And Michael's going to lead us through that. Evil. It's nature, aims, and corruption. Because she's so pure, we picked Kirsten to handle that. And then finally, we'll do romance among swords and lightsabers. Great lines like, I hate sand. Probably not. So, really, anything else that our panelists feel like talking about, and as you've already seen, Michael is egging the panelists along. If we have time, we're going to delay a rant. But here's a quick poll for you guys to find out which fandom you belong to. So, you see The Matrix, you either love or hate Middle Earth, and love or hate Star Wars, and I am talking about episodes 4 through 6. So we'll give you that. And so do we have any ring bearers in the room? People that, I could leave or take Star Wars, but man, I love me some Little Earth. We got a few over on each wing. Good, we'll call you guys the ring bearers. How about folks in the upper quadrant? We'll call you guys Padawans. Any Star Wars folks that are here that are here to defend Star Wars? But not so much. You know, the videos that say, hey, those Lord of the Rings movies are just walking. Lowering them volcanoes.
It's a low blow.
So anyway, we'll call you Padawans. General nerdists. Good. I will take lightsabers in the Lord of the Rings. That's okay with me. Is there anybody in the room that is an unwilling captive? Someone here who's being dragged to Mount Doom because you're friends. Yeah. Thank you for coming. We'll try to keep it entertaining for you. A few quick comparisons before we dive right into our themes. Lord of the Rings is called the fantasy genre, but it's really kind of myth, and in some ways it's even history. Yeah. Star Wars has been called, obviously it's sci-fi, but in some ways it's called a space opera or a space soap opera. So we'll get into some of those things. Obviously Lord of the Rings went from books and over time and sometimes begrudgingly into films, whereas Star Wars starts as films and then lots and lots and lots of books have been published by it. So kind of a reverse angle there. The point of, you know, destroy the ring, save Middle Earth. There's our core theme. Save the galaxy from the evil Sith-dominated empire. Quest drives the plot. of the Lord of the Rings. It is a mission to defeat Sauron, destroy the ring, all kind of connected together. In some ways, I'd argue that family drives the plot in a lot of Star Wars. And so you see lots of those kinds of family stories that are developing. And surprises! So don't kiss your sister. Although, if you go to Turin published in 1954-55, and obviously the films 2001-3 and The Hobbits in 2012-14, released in 77-83. So some different sensibilities, and 95-2005 for the last three, and then this year, 2015. The series in the movie world grossed $5.9 billion in The Lord of the Rings and $4.4 billion in Star Wars. So that's probably
right.
Yeah.
Price inflation,
okay. I did not inflation adjust this, sorry. Okay, 17.2 hours of theatrical runtime versus 13.3 hours of theatrical runtime. So more for your butt. All that walking.
Yeah.
And in Lord of the Rings, we have a bearded director with a bias for action over romance. And in Star Wars, we have a bearded director with a bias for action over romance. In fact, those guys are actually possible to see together. Okay. You could even ask, did the Lord of the Rings have any influence over George Lucas? Well, you don't have to go a lot further than Willow, 1988. Anybody remember?
Yes.
And what Lucas said about that movie was, a lot of my movies are about a little guy against the system. And this was just a more literal interpretation of that idea. So Lucas, who was a screenwriter for that movie, has played around in medieval times and dragons and swords and little people who win. So, okay, we're going to dive right into our 11 heroes. Constance is going to leave us there. So in The Lord of the Rings, you do have, obviously, heroes that are at various stages of reluctance. So Theoden is one. You've got Obi-Wan Kenobi hiding on a desert planet for a long period of time. What is he doing there? You've got trees that are hiding in the woods. You've got people hiding in the
it's
woods.
It's a good place to hide.
That's right.
Your tree, that's where I go. I mean, that's a great place. Immediately.
And then obviously, we can debate this. You guys can debate if you want. But one of the core heroes is Frodo. And that's his mission, it's his charge. The obvious core hero in a lot of the Star Wars saga is Luke. He's going to be back. And so, with that, I have a few questions. I think I'm just going to skip my quote. Well, we'll see. I wish the ring had never come to me. There's Bilbo. I wish none of it had happened. Or sorry, Frodo. Or Luke says, I can't get involved. I hate it, but there's nothing I can do about it right now. It's all such a long way from here. He gets one over to that. So we'll let Constance go. I'm going to put up some starter questions. Constance already has those. But we'll let her dive in to Frodo and Luke and multiple heroes and all that stuff.
This actually could be, just this one topic alone, could be several hours with a test, okay? At the end of it. We're not going to do that. But when Jim and I were discussing this, when he first proposed this to all of us, and we had our discussion about reluctant heroes, I thought, well, yeah, that's actually a very intriguing topic. And Frodo is my main concern, but let's start with him then, okay. Frodo is a reluctant hero at first, but he's also, I thought about this question and I said, reluctant in both capacities, whatever universe we're playing in here, whether playing in Lord of the Rings or Star Wars, etc., reluctant hero actually means a thoughtful hero. Right? This is someone who actually measures the situation, not just for their self-concern. They go through an evolution, a story arc where they grow as people, but they're still thinking about not only what does this mean for me, but what does this mean for my community? And that is really particular to Frodo to begin with, because it's explained to him by Gandalf, you know, you have this ring, this is what it involves in possessing it, etc. And his comment, and I'll explain the difference between the book and the movie, his comment in the book is that, well, I suppose I have to guard the ring no matter what it may do to me, because he's very, as a hobbit, very community-minded, even though he himself is not involved in raising a huge family or anything like that, he still is very much caring of his community, other hobbits, and so he said, I'll take it. And even if I have to leave, you know, and to safeguard my community, I'll feel better knowing that I've taken the danger away from people who matter to me. But he comes to that point when he thinks about it, and when he takes it on at that point sitting in his comfortable kitchen at Bag End, and then he reconsiders what he's doing along the way. He never steps down from it, though. He may think about what does it mean at this point, what does it mean at that point, but he's always measuring what the concern would be for the larger community, first for his community, the people he knows, and then for the world at large. As he grows in spiritual enlargement himself, he begins to realize that I am basically a small person, but this is a big matter. Maybe it's too great for me, but I'm the one who's taken it on. And through his example of willingness to take on a burden, he inspires other people to rise to their level of greatness, I guess, you know. So he has greatness thrust upon him. He wouldn't say that himself, but that's exactly what happens to him. So that one particular quote at the beginning of the book where he says, no matter what it may do to me, I'll take it and I'll guard it, actually is there in the privacy of his own home, before he even knows what really what this means, he does take on this burden after some careful consideration, and he keeps thinking about it constantly. In the film, I find this rather interesting, where you don't have this, I'll take it no matter what it does to me, where he's standing in the parlor and just says, what must I do? That's it. You see the thought process going on, and he accepts it. And the answer, of course, that's unspoken is everything. You give up everything to do this, and he still does it. You know? So I find that rather fascinating and very, you know, very spiritually uplifting. Luke, okay, is somebody who comes to it. Now, you have to bear in mind that Luke is essentially an adolescent, and Frodo is not. Frodo is 50. He's presented as very young in the films, too, but it's still, like, you have to think of a Hobbit lifespan. So he's young for Hobbit, but he seems to have a little bit more maturity than Luke may have at that point, and Luke is saying things like, well, it is so far away, and, you know, I can't do anything about it, and that is kind of like an adolescent response to the situation, until his family is killed, and it's like, there's nothing left for me here. So he goes off and says, well, now I guess I have to follow through on what's being thrust upon me anyway, but he still makes the decision to do it. And then in our initial discussion, I said, well, what about Han Solo, who seems to be, you know, a champion of self-interest, but he actually does step up when he puts on a brave front, like, I don't care about anybody but myself, but that's not really true, as this is evidenced, etc. I would like, you know, questions, or something we can talk more. I could talk for an hour and a half, so I don't...
So let's open up to the panel in terms of just heroes, and what you guys see in terms of their story arcs or progression as heroes, or multiple types of heroes that you're seeing in both works. Who handles heroism better?
Well, I'll jump off on the impulsiveness point for Luke, because I think there's something to be said for that idea. Both of them, you know, do have, as you say, greatness sort of thrust upon them in different ways. They don't want to have that. And both of them have their mentors, Obi-Wan, obviously, for Luke, and Gandalf for Frodo. But you get the sense that, you know, where Luke sort of observes Obi-Wan with the sense of he's Ben, he's old Ben Kenobi, he doesn't even realize that he's this, you know, incredibly powerful Jedi until somewhat later. And eventually he comes to revere him, but you get the sense when he loses him that he's losing this person who was partially a father figure and a mentor, yes, but also a friend. The loss, it seems to me, of Gandalf for Frodo is even more sort of palpable, and I think it's exceptionally well done in the movie, which is one of the strongest parts of that movie, I think. The whole sort of, you know, I don't know, minute and a half at least after Gandalf falls and they're all running out, you get the sense of the incredible loss, partly, I think, because Frodo understands the degree to which Gandalf's loss, as he assumes permanent loss, what that means for all of Middle-earth, period. You get the sense Luke is upset because he's lost Ben, right? Frodo is upset because we've all lost Gandalf, and I think that goes back to the community point that you were making, that there is this emphasis on the hero tied into a community as opposed to a hero tied into himself, and that may have to do with their relative age. Later on, Luke, I think, gains that knowledge of where he stands with the rest of the universe and the rest of the people with his team and his family and his group, and he begins to broaden out his reach. But initially, Luke's reaction when Ben is cut down is, I'm just, you know, my God, like a child, oh my God, I've just lost this thing. Frodo's reaction is, I've lost him, but my God, what have we all lost in the process? So,
I would tend to agree to that, that they, the mentors that each of these people have along the way are extremely important to them. And part of the growth process of heroism that they all display is the realization that nobody acts alone and that I've gotten to this point because of all these people. Frodo has several mentors. Gandalf is the first, but then Aragorn is one as well, and so is Galadriel. Okay, so they're all...
It's interesting that they're both orphans.
Luke and Frodo.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of typical old English romance questing archetype, you know, that the character has to go forth alone with a mentoring character, but often also with a father figure against which the questing character has to rebel. And the being an orphan is an important part of that because comfortable, safe family life doesn't usually lend to desire to go out on a quest. But I think quite interestingly, although they are both these reluctant heroes that you're talking about, they both have a core desire for adventure, which is unusual for where they come from. You know, Luke is this farm boy on Tatooine, and Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru are trying to kind of squash this adventure desire that they believe will be in him, that he will have inherited from his father. And Frodo wanted to be off on one of Bilbo's adventures with him, which is unusual for a hobbit. So although they have that, when it comes to the moment of setting out, that, oh my God, what does this actually mean? At their core, they do have a desire for adventure, which I think is key.
I'd like to add one quick thing. Both Lucas and Tolkien have a multiplicity of heroes or heroic types. And one of them, one of the other types that isn't discussed very often is the fallen hero. And I won't get too much into that, but there's also the unknown hero. You know, Boromir was very well known in Gondor, but nobody knew who he was in the North. And Frodo, of course, was a nobody when he got back to the Shire, which outraged the other hobbits. In the Star Wars franchise, I'm going to include chapters 1 through 3.
Oh, okay.
There are a couple of fallen heroes. There are several fallen heroes in Star Wars. And, of course, you know, one of them is Anakin. Jar Jar Binks is a fallen hero. And, you know, I know everybody hates Jar Jar Binks. He got on my nerves at first, too. But he's a really very interesting character if you can force yourself to take the time to study him. Because he is a hero in the first movie. You know, he brings the humans and the Gungans together. And then he ends up betraying the entire Republic as a tool of the Sith Lord, you know. So they both, Lucas and Tolkien, love fallen hero stereotypes, or archetypes, I guess we could say. So I'll just leave it at that.
So there you go. Loving Jar Jar is like eating spinach. let's move into the next theme. We're skipping along, but good. We're going to hand it to Greg to talk about fall and redemption. So, as I said, there are lots of interesting fall and redemption kinds of stories. The whole Army of the Dead and the King of the Dead, and that storyline, or Han Solo, kind of a storyline from. Sorry, Han. Oh, you love
more than Jar Jar? It's just a statement of fact. Just realities.
We
put that.
Home,
set that out.
Chewie and come back. So the Gollum storyline, mm-hmm. and the near redemption that happens on the stairs of Kira the Mongol, or the Lando Calrissian. Is he a betrayer? Is he working for the Empire? Is he one of us? So that whole question mark. Two of the big obvious redemption themes involve Boromir, and then the whole Anakin Darth Vader storyline. Sorry, spoilers. Anakin was, okay, sorry. He's also Luke's father.
Flips the table. Hell with this nonsense.
So here's what Tolkien said. Nothing moves my heart beyond all the passions and heartbreaks of the world so much as ennoblement. Ennoblement, from the ugly duckling to Frodo. So he's an equal opportunity ennoblement addict. And then John Seabrook in a 1997 interview with George Lucas, when I asked George Lucas what Star Wars was ultimately about, he said redemption. So we're going to tie that in. Greg, too, has these questions about fall and redemption and those resonating themes, mm-hmm. And how they're different or how they're handled alike. I'm arguing that Tolkien especially has more of a redemptive tragedy in mind. So you get Gollums and Denethors, where Lucas gives us more comedy and rogues, like Han Solo and Lando Calrissian. And you know, just poking at what's the most unlikely or dangerous fall? You know, if Gandalf or Galadriel or Obi-Wan or Leia or Jar Jar fell. Or the toughest redemption, Sauron or Saruman or the Emperor or Jabba the Hutt. So...
Mm-hmm.
give it to Greg.
I want to start with a quick side note, which I hadn't thought about until we were just talking just now, which is that one of the saddest moments Tolkien always felt about the book was Sam's inability to understand Gollum's change. And it is Sam's treatment of Gollum, remember, that ultimately turns Gollum back in the other direction. Everybody loves Sam. I love Sam, too. But it is an incredible failure of Sam's provincialism and his bigotry that he can't get past that belief that Gollum might actually have changed for the better. So Gollum is really a failed redemption story, a story that was almost redemption. I think it's really hard to argue that Gollum redeems himself by accidentally falling into the crack of doom, okay? Like, I think that's a little bit of a stretch. Had he taken it, looked at Frodo, winked, and then leaped to his death, maybe? But I mean, come on. So, no, but I think...
The wink is critical.
Yeah, but that failure, yeah, right, sort of a... But the failure, I think, is very sad there. So a couple things I want to say quickly about the redemption aspect. On the panel yesterday about Lord of the Rings and Westeros, Middle-earth and Westeros, I talked about the idea that in Westeros, redemption is a fluid process. That is to say that people can be redeemed, can fall again, can redeem again, can fall again. If you want an example, look at Tyrion Lannister. Just read him. And you'll get redemption, fall, redemption, fall. Yeah, right. But in Lord of the Rings...
But in
Lord of the Rings, the redemption is a much more permanent process, by which I mean that redemption is almost always followed by, in Lord of the Rings, the end of that particular character, right? We capture in our mind his moment of redemption, and that's it. Boromir attempts to take the ring from Frodo, and because he does that, the fellowship itself is broken. So it's a big deal what Boromir ultimately does, and he pays for it with his life. He sacrifices himself to be able to save the ring bearer. We find him exceptionally noble in the end and all that, but the point is he's paying the price for it. So we remember Boromir then as a character that's tragic, but not tragic because he failed to be redeemed, but because in his redemption he sacrificed himself, right? That's Boromir's character. You could argue the same thing happens with the Army of the Dead in terms of its finality. The Army of the Dead serves Aragorn as they are supposed to. They help at the Battle of Pelennor Fields, and then they are swept away to the relief of many of the living people and to the disappointment of those who are tactical and are like, this would be awesome if we still had this dead army, you know, but they go away. So that moment again is captured in our mind, right, that they have redeemed themselves and then they're gone. I'd argue that unlike Westeros, I think Star Wars does much the same thing for its tragic characters. So it's not until the very end of the current movie cycle, anyway, that Darth Vader ultimately finds his redemption through one decision, I would point out. You know, he may get to that decision through a variety of inputs, but it's the one decision that he makes to betray the Emperor. He doesn't go through this big tactical thing and, haha, I was working for Luke all the time. It's that last moment where the Emperor, in his arrogance, believes that he has such great control over everyone and has foreseen everything that he can do this, and it doesn't occur to him that he has not foreseen the one spark of goodness which Luke saw, and nobody else, including Obi-Wan Kenobi, saw in Darth Vader that allows Vader to pick up the Emperor and throw him to his death. That, again, causes Vader's extinction, right, at least as an entity. Yes, he comes back later on as one of the happy, waving people. I think we talked about this yesterday in the Westeros panel. That's true, but in terms of Vader as Vader, right? Leave Anakin aside. If you think of Vader almost as his own separate thing, Vader is fixed in our mind as an ultimately redemptive figure through his sacrifice at the end, right? So I think they're very similar in that respect. Where Star Wars departs from Lord of the Rings, I think, is that the more comic characters or roguish characters, people like Han, people like Lando, do have the opportunity to be redeemed, and we get to see what happens after they've been redeemed. But I'd argue the difference there is they're much more like Westeros when it comes to characters that are going to continue to have these fluid sort of rises and falls. And I would also point out, and I think this is the most important aspect of their, you know, nature of redemption, each of these characters that we're talking about has a redemption that is, or a fall that is concomitant to what they did before. By which I mean, if they really, really, really did bad things, their payment, the cost to them of what they have to pay to be redeemed, is concomitantly more. I don't think I need to make any argument about how bad Darth Vader was. I think that's pretty obvious. And so ultimately, the only way, in a way, he can be redeemed is through the payment of his own life, at least from a moral point of view, right? Lando betrays his friends, and for that, he loses Cloud City. He loses his, you know, reputation. He obviously is on the run, but he's not going to die because Lando very quickly changed around when he saw what he was actually doing to those people on the ground, and he understood that there was an impact to what he did, and so Lando moves past that much more quickly. Han is somewhere in the middle. You know, Han ultimately is redeemed, but Han pays a heck of a cost to get to that point. You know, he ends up being frozen in carbonite. He ends up being shipped off to Jabba. There's a very real possibility that Han's not going to make it, but Han did a lot of bad stuff, is the impression you get. He was a smuggler, and he didn't just smuggle bad people, right? You know, he was smuggling lots and lots of, you know, he did bad things to lots of people, good, bad, and indifferent. He did shoot first, damn it. So, you know... So Han is this kind of character that does, you know, those sorts of things, and as a consequence, he has to pay a price that is not quite to death, but is pretty close along those lines. In Lord of the Rings, obviously, as I've already talked about, that redemptive quality still exists, and so you have Boromir as a character who, as I've said, has to sort of pay the price with his own life. And incidentally, when Boromir is speaking to Aragorn about it and is talking to him about what he's done, he said, "I have tried to take the ring, I have paid." So he is conscious of the sacrifice that he made, and in some ways, it means that a character like Faramir, although Faramir is in many ways a much better version of his brother than Boromir, he's much kinder, he's smarter, he understands things better, and he is in some ways less subject to the selfishness that Boromir is. But Faramir as a character, in a way, doesn't stick with us to the same degree as Boromir. Why? Because Boromir went that far down the line, and to come back has to sacrifice all of himself to get there. So those, I think, are the ways that Star Wars and Lord of the Rings do things very similarly. The permanence of the redemption depending on tragic or comic characters.
Cool, very good. I'm going to open up the panel, but let me just point out before I do that. Now, what other Dragon Con panel are you going to hear the word incompetent used? Not only as an adjective, but as an adverb in the same presentation. So, erudition.
It might be an enemy. Concomitant Binks will come up. Concomitant Hutt. Concomitant Dooku. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think, interestingly, Gregory, what you're saying about the sort of difference there, to me the key difference is one of religion and spirituality in a way from the perception of the creators.
Okay.
So in Star Wars, yes, we have the ultimate redemption is an ascension, if you like, and that's what we see, for me, that's what we see in Tolkien's writing, that to be redeemed, it's an ascension, and so you can't come back from that. The redemption is what kind of buys you your place in heaven, if you like. And so if you were redeemed and survived, well, where's the ascension? You've lost out on the ultimate reward of your redemption, which is to go beyond, to go into the West. And in Star Wars, we have an element of that, with Vader, with those characters, but there are characters that we don't really want to see redeemed in that way, because we like the thought that being naughty, being wicked, is okay, right? So we were talking about Tyrion Lannister and does lots of terrible things, but kind of charming in many ways. And so in Star Wars, like, personally, I don't really want Han to be redeemed. I like Han shooting first. I like him the way he is. And I don't think Tolkien, in his own spiritual beliefs, had a sense of delight in the mischievous, in the naughty, in the wicked. That wasn't who he was, you know. And so we don't get characters in his writing who do peccadilloes, right? The little sins that we don't really want them to be redeemed from, because we don't want them to ascend. We want them to stay with us. We're mundane. We're naughty. We make mistakes. And we want that to be kind of okay and not needing ultimate redemption. And I don't think Tolkien saw life like that.
I was just going to say Merry and Pippin. Yeah,
they're not wicked, though, really, are they? I mean, what did Merry and Pippin ever do that...
I don't think they were naughty.
I don't think they actually smoked pot, you know, I mean, I know it seems like that in the movie.
Pippin might be a candidate for an argument. I don't think he's naughty, but he does betray the Fellowship twice. He drops the stone in the well, and then he picks up the Palantir.
Almost disastrously.
The Palantir episode, though, was quite fortuitous. It prevented... It saved Gandalf, and true. It also gave Aragorn a tool to use against Sauron.
True.
The stone in the well, after 40 years, I'm still debating whether that was good or bad, but I don't think Pippin is a Han Solo kind of character. And so I think Kirsten's right. I agree with her. I don't think they have those kinds of characters in The Lord of the Rings.
Sorry, just kind of following on to what Kirsten said, one of the criticisms that people sometimes will leverage against Lord of the Rings is the characters, they're so rarefied, they're difficult to relate to, many of them. And one of the things that makes some of the characters perhaps easier to relate to in a work like Star Wars is that little thread of naughtiness. Because we can imagine ourselves being in those situations, and we don't always make the best decisions. Of course, the characters in The Lord of the Rings don't always make the best decisions either. For example, Pippin and the silly things that he does. But it's perhaps a little more overt in some of the characters in Star Wars. So even with the theme of redemption, we need to be able to kind of cast ourselves in those roles for those themes to really come through to us. And that bit of naughtiness helps that.
We're going to keep moving on. But if we had more time, we'd talk about the ambitions of Tom Bombadil, but we won't. but Michael's already gone down a path where you're, for example, you look at particular incidents that look like a really bad thing has just happened. And it turns out that it was actually a pivotal point where it led to really critical things happening. So this idea of destiny and then how that plays into free agency or being sort of the free will idea. And so the whole storyline from Bilbo stumbling across this ring until we hit to the cracks of Mount Doom, and you get the whole Gollum component of that story. Or the obvious one when we start with a cute little kid riding speed racers around the planet. That turns into Darth Vader. And so that whole progression of story arc there. So just some quick quotes. You know, the Gandalf, all we have to do is to decide what to do with the time that is given to us. So someone's giving us time. There are other forces at work in this world, Frodo, besides evil. Bilbo was meant to find the ring, in which case you were meant to find it. And that's an encouraging thought. Interestingly, in the book, Frodo says, no, it's not an encouraging thought. Whereas Darth Vader says, Luke, you can destroy the Emperor. He has foreseen this. It's your destiny. Join me, and together we can rule the galaxy as father and son. So even before he gets to that spark of goodness, he's got a spark of badness, and yet it's ultimately leading to some kind of destined path. So Michael's going to kick us into that.
So I'm going to go off on a little tangent first, okay? I understand Tolkien's thoughts better than I understand George Lucas's thoughts. And so I'm going to kind of treat Lucas as a bit mechanical. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way. I just haven't studied Lucas the way I've studied Tolkien. So to the Lucas fans in the room, if you feel like you understand them better than I do, you probably do, okay? But Tolkien was a devout Catholic. Now, he was not like a modern fundamentalist Protestant reading the Book of Apocalypse. But how many of you have read the Book of the Apocalypse, Apocalypse St. John? I mean, you all familiar with... Oh, come on. Nobody here has read the Bible? I mean, Revelation. Revelation. Okay. So let me bring up something that Tolkien would have called applicability. Okay, in a Revelation, you have the Mark of the Beast. And basically, the story of the Mark of the Beast is that people get it either on their hand or on their forehead, and they can't buy or sell if they don't have this mark. A couple of weeks ago, in Russia, a security firm called Kaspersky demonstrated a rice-sized computer chip that is put in your hand, and it can be used exactly the same way as a smartphone for biometric identification and buying and selling. Combine that with the news that just came out of the Islamic State that people in the cities that they have conquered are being forced out of business and not allowed to work unless they swear allegiance to the Islamic State. So they're using the kind of economic oppression that was predicted in the Bible almost 2,000 years ago. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say about the Bible. But Tolkien was very Christian, and for him, prophecy was a very important aspect of his literature. It was also very important to all mythologies. Okay, we don't have time to go into how Tolkien defined mythology, but basically we all have mythologies. And in all mythologies that Tolkien studied, prophecy was always an important thing. And the prophecies were always attributable in Tolkien. in Tolkien's literature. The prophecies ultimately come from some outside source, which Jim alluded to. You know, something gave us that time, and of course it's God. And there have been many academic arguments about the role of God behind the scenes, pulling the strings in the Lord of the Rings. You know, so destiny versus free will in the Lord of the Rings, if you're kind of like predestined to be Gollum and you can't be redeemed, is that really fair to you? Okay, and this is of course a question that has plagued Christianity for almost 2,000 years, and probably Judaism and quite a few other faiths. In Star Wars, you have an unattributed prophecy. Now, I'm not going to try and include the books. They're too confusing for me, okay? And I haven't read them all. So in the movies, you have the prophecy that the Force is going to be restored to balance by something. And Qui-Gon Jinn finds a vergence in the Force, and he thinks that the prophecy is about to be fulfilled. The Jedi, of course, don't think the Force is out of balance. So they're kind of in Gollum's role, in my opinion. And I felt like the Jedi... at the time that Anakin came along, had become very arrogant and set in their ways, and in some ways were kind of locked into a goose step towards evil, and they just didn't realize it. And so it was kind of inevitable that there would be a schism within the Jedi Order. Now, of course, if we go into the extended universe, the Jedi have been divided in the past. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that convoluted history. There are plenty of wikis on the internet to try to explain it. But basically what happens with the Jedi is they become kind of rigid and fixed, and then they split. And that split results in conflict between good guys and bad guys. And eventually somebody came up with this prophecy that the Force was going to try and fix it all. Well, fix it all by wiping everybody out, you know, and then starting over from scratch. Tolkien doesn't do that. He doesn't wipe everybody out. He wipes out about 90% of everybody. And then, you know, he kind of starts over, but not exactly from scratch. But both Tolkien and Lucas bring up this question without really trying to answer it. How much free will do you really have to act within this great story that is being told? The storyteller is external. The Force is kind of, in my view, an impartial benevolence. It doesn't care if you're good or evil, as long as you don't disrupt the balance. So you can do bad things or you can do good things. In the Lord of the Rings universe, Ilúvatar, God, he does care. And he's going to let you do bad things. If you want to choose to be evil, this is a very Christian point of view, of course. If you want to choose to be evil, you're going to have some time to be evil. And then eventually you're going to pay the piper. Okay, so the destiny of the world in the Lord of the Rings is that eventually everything will be fixed, and people are going to be sorted into those who did the right thing somehow, and those who did not do the right thing. In Star Wars, it's not really, to me, it's not that clear that there is a final ultimate end to the story. The Force just felt like things had gone too far in one direction, and so it corrected the market, so to speak, if I can talk like an economist. And so who knows where they're going to go with the Star Wars universe from now on. I mean, you have new powers that be deciding the stories, but I think Lucas was very ambiguous, whereas Tolkien was very, very clear about following in the footsteps of biblical teachings, and I'm going to leave it at that.
Okay. Any thoughts from the panel on this whole destiny?
Just one that I want to point out about the destiny argument has to do with the nature of understanding what that destiny is, which is where I think people tend to get it wrong. And I think it happens with the Jedi, who believe they know what the Force wants and desires for them, and I think, as you pointed out, don't necessarily get it right. And there's a certain humility, it seems to me, that the best characters have in making decisions that ultimately guide their destiny. So, as I talked about, the only reason that the ring is destroyed, ultimately, is because of Gollum. Frodo would not have been able to do it on his own. And from Frodo himself says this. He says, if it hadn't been for Gollum, I wouldn't have been able to destroy the ring. Keep in mind that it was Bilbo himself who, when he had the opportunity to kill Gollum, did not. And later on, Frodo says to Gandalf, why didn't he just kill him when he had the chance? And Gandalf has that, you know, wonderful speech where he responds to him and says, in part, you know, even the wise cannot see all ends. That kind of humility is critically important, and it means that we understand there is a destiny, Tolkien says, but we don't know where that destiny is going to lead us, and so it behooves us to move carefully. When we don't do that, when we become Saruman or Denethor, and we believe that we need ever more and greater knowledge, and believe then we understand the whole picture when we don't. Remember, Denethor doesn't get all of it. He gets what he's allowed to see by Sauron, and that tragically moves Denethor in the wrong direction. He thinks he knows, and he doesn't. Frodo is humble enough to know that he doesn't know all the answers. He learns that from Gandalf, and his ability to sort of be humble in that way is ultimately what leads to the destruction of the ring. So it's not just about destiny to me. It's also about us understanding how much of the destiny we can or can't see and being humble enough to accept that we don't see all the paths we lead to.
Well, Frodo also is somebody who is essentially a channel for grace. He's given grace to act in a certain way, to get to a certain point, to allow these things to happen. And as you say, he says, I couldn't have done it on my own. And that doesn't diminish, you know, his heroism at all. It actually inspires other people to act in their best possible way.
Yes.
So that they're all instruments of providence in this story, and Frodo is the channel for that, I think. And it doesn't make him God, it simply makes him as, you know, I guess an example who was willing to expend himself in the quest, and other people say, hey, if this guy can do it, what am I sitting on my rear end for?
You know, right.
So I'll step up.
Right.
Okay, I can't believe somewhere there, there wasn't the quote, there is no try.
It's do or do not.
Do or do not.
Yeah.
But Michael gave us this really interesting visual image of Jedi goose stepping toward evil.
Yeah. I think.
So we will use that to launch us into the evil theme. So obviously there are evil characters throughout. There's really pretty evil like Saruman and Darth Vader. There's sort of unmitigated evil like the Uruk-hai or Jabba. And then you have, you know, the archetypical evil, you know, Sauron and the Emperor. And if you really wanted to get to it, you could have Sith Nazgul.
That's just...
So we're going to take it over to Tolkien in his letter says, evil labors with vast power and perpetual success in vain. Preparing always only the soil for unexpected good to sprout in, the grace theme that Constance talked about. Lucas, in one of his commentaries, one of the issues in all of this is that bad guys think they're good. Interestingly, he's trying to make an argument for why the Emperor, Lord Sidious, thinks he's bringing peace to the galaxy because there's so much corruption and confusion and chaos going on, and that now he's going to be able to straighten everything out, which may be true, but the price of the galaxy he's going to have to pay is way too much. Sort of a Saruman-esque justification. So we'll use that and hand it over to Kirsten.
So this is a big topic. Evil is a big topic. And there are many philosophical paths down which we could go. So I'm going to keep it simple because of time constraints. When I started thinking about this, and I thought, well, who am I going to pick who represents evil in these two mythologies that we're thinking about here? Because, of course, there are, as Jim has just mentioned, sort of many faces, many evil characters, and you have the father figure who's evil, so you have Palpatine, and then you have Vader, or you have Melkor, and then you have Sauron, and, you know, so... I decided to think primarily about the characters that, in my mind, with relation to the films, stick in your head as the personification of evil. So ignore the ring for a moment, because I kind of see the ring as not having that kind of characteristic, as it was created by another character. So for me, it's Vader and Sauron, who kind of stand out as the personification of the evil that is in these stories. And one of the things that they immediately have in common is they are tall, dark, armored figures. And that is absolutely standard in film, in literature. We see that so often that the evil character is really tall. Look at the Hound in Westeros, right? Really tall, darkly clad, often with a helmet that obscures the face. It takes away a sense of the humanity. We see it in, for example, if any of you have seen Dragon, the Bruce Lee story, the samurai that he fears in his nightmares is this enormously tall, darkly armored samurai. In Susan Cooper's The Darkest Rising books, the rider is a tall man in a dark cloak. So I started thinking, well, why is evil always depicted, it seems, in this way, the tall, clad in armor, dark figure? And I think it's because evil has this big, omnipresent sense for us. I think this is what we see in mythology often, that evil feels like the prevailing presence. It's that sense that the world is primarily dark, and the good in the world is small, that it has to find a way to shine through the overriding darkness, you know. So we have the sense, again, of hobbits fighting Oliphants, or Ewoks fighting Atsters, you know, the scout walkers. It's this sense, as Shakespeare would put it, so shines a good deed in a naughty world, right? The world is primarily the dark place, and the one little candlelight in the darkness is what we're looking for. So is that true? Is evil the pervasive thing? Do we need the very smallest person who can somehow fight against this large dark presence? If we started to think about evil in a religious sense, of course, for Tolkien, again, we've already mentioned his Christianity. There's a sense that since man fell, evil has always been present, that we don't have a choice about that, that we are descended from fallen man, and therefore we are darkened. But because of, in the Christian sense, because of the sacrifice of Christ, there is constant redemption. That's a redemption that has been paid once and exists forever. So we cannot help the fact that we are naturally in a dark state, but neither can we change the fact that we are always redeemed by this constant act. So that would be sort of Tolkien's take on it, but that spirituality doesn't necessarily apply to Star Wars mythology. So is there darkness within us all, or are there midichlorians within us all? Who knows? But certainly we all have the potential to be corrupted, or if we say the darkness is already present, for that darkness to come forward in us. But usually, and this sort of ties into what we were just talking about, usually that comes through pride. The thing that seems to be the trigger for evil to be able to overrule your good instincts, your redeeming instincts, is pride, is hubris, is ambition, is overreaching. So the reason that the ring doesn't corrupt certain characters, we could argue, and leaving Tom Bombadil aside for a moment, is that they're not seeking power. So Aragorn does not want to be king. And therefore, although the ring is a temptation for him and he is wary of it, it is less dangerous to him than it is to a character like Boromir. Frodo does not want power. He has no interest in having power, and therefore the ring is not the threat to him in the same way that it is to a character who is seeking power. So we see again and again that those who want power, Saruman, are corrupted because they're seeking this power. And evil, this dark, large, omnipresent force, is always looking for those weak moments when we seek power. Again, it goes back to the sort of oldest archetype of the god figure who has their brightest and best pupil, Lucifer, who, because of his talents and skills, overreaches and falls. Same pattern with Ilúvatar and his brightest and best of the Valar, the greatest, Melkor, who then falls, overreaches himself and becomes something other, a darkness. But where I fell short on this was I couldn't quite see why Luke doesn't succumb. Because I get the sense that Luke does have pride. He does want power. When he says, I am a Jedi like my father before me, that's not humility that's making him say, I won't succumb. It's kind of pride in his strength as a warrior and pride in his family heritage. And this took me back to what Jim said right at the beginning that he saw that Lord of the Rings is driven by quest, Star Wars is perhaps driven more by family. Perhaps what saves Vader and what prevents Luke from succumbing is love. It's that sense that he can be proud of his father, even though he's only known his father as Vader. But he has a pride in what he believes his father once was. And so in Tolkien we see that evil is ever present, and only the small good glimmers in the darkness can save us, and the desire not to be a bright, shining, powerful light, but to be a small candle, a good deed in a naughty world, is what saves you from evil. Perhaps in Star Wars we still have the dark, pervading presence of evil, but it's love, and love for our family around us, love for our comrades, our rebellion around us, that saves us from succumbing to that evil.
Cool. So we'll get evil thoughts from our panel. I will point out, I think Greg is the tallest guy on the panel.
You'll note I'm wearing nothing dark. I just want to say one very quick thing, which is that I would point out that, one, I wonder if Luke's determination when he says, I am a Jedi like my father was before me, isn't also a reference to his happiness that he has conquered a portion of himself. You know, he remembers his failure at the cave, where he explicitly did not do what he does in this chance, and that is, does not kill his father the way he does in the cave. So there may be something to that. Other thing I want to say quickly, one of the things that evil repeatedly does in almost everything you study, from the Chronicles of Narnia to even all the way to Paradise Lost, is evil always has a tendency to focus so much on the big picture, so much on what it thinks is actual power, that it misses the small that indicates the possibility of a weakness. So Tarkin on the Death Star, they say, you know, we've analyzed the attack pattern, there is a danger, and he says, I think you've mistaken at the time of our greatest triumph, and it's this little, however big it is, right, foot hole, meter wide hole, that ultimately destroys the Death Star. It is that continual failure to misunderstand. Saruman saying to Gandalf, you're always interested in the halflings with their leaf, as to their pipe leaf, pipeweed has clearly clouded your mind, because he despises the smallness of them. It is their smallness, their humility, that ultimately overthrows evil, and evil perpetually makes that mistake.
Yeah, and also, just following on really to what Gregory said and Kirsten, that moment, I'm a Jedi like my father before me. It's so the love and that having conquered himself, but I think I see it also as Luke's own faith, we want to call it faith, and his, you know, his insistence, there is good in him.
Yep.
I feel it.
Yep.
He is a Jedi. He is not a Sith. I know it. I have faith in this. So I see that way also.
Yep.
We're gonna let Valdis bring us home. And it's interesting because even in this evil conversation, Kirsten has brought up the theme of love. So, you know, and we're going to shift over to this idea of love or of romance as you see it. Neither Lucas or Tolkien are particularly noteworthy for their romantic writings, but we do have, you know, Arwen loves Aragorn, Han loves Leia, Sam loves Rosie.
Torin loves his sister.
I guess, yeah.
Anakin, too soon.
Yeah,
too soon.
Right, too soon. Too soon. So some quickies. You know, I would rather share one lifetime with you than facing all the ages of the world alone. Arwen loves Aragorn. Or Rosie Cotton dancing, she had a rose in her hair. When I should have married, I would have married her. My wife got that lanyard here at Dragon Con. Versus why you stuck up, half-witted, scruffy-looking nerf herder, and I love you, I know. Or
just poetry. It's just
sorry, but I don't like sand. It's coarse and rough. It's not like hair. Sorry. I told the Star Wars track I was going to be kind. It's the Tolkien track, and it's an equal opportunity. All of our name tags have the Star Wars and the Lord of the Rings. I'm trying to be balanced. So we've given Valdis some starter questions, but take us home.
So these starter questions really kind of packed in there. And so I just have to, you know, quickly say, when I forgot my assignment for the panel, no offense at all, Jim, I look at this, I have romance. Wah, wah. Well, all right, I guess I can think about that. So, yeah, perhaps romance is not, I mean, certainly these are not romantic movies in the sense that they're built around love stories, but love is definitely a very important theme, love of many different kinds, and, you know, trying to focus here on romantic love. really thinking about all of the topics on this panel, and we have circled around the edge of this a lot, but both of these stories are retellings with variation and much invention on the archetypal mythical hero's journey. You know, every one of these themes that we've discussed are integral to the hero's journey. And, of course, part of the hero's journey is the reward at the end. And the reward at the end usually involves a marriage. Of course, what we have in both of these stories, as has already been pointed out, we have many different heroes. And so exactly which one ends up with the girl at the end is perhaps not always the one we might think of as the central hero. But I can't think too deeply about either one of these stories without really beginning to think about the hero's journey, because it is absolutely central. And this is one of the things that does make these stories resonate so much for us now. And I would argue, in my humble opinion, with both of these, will make them continue to resonate for many, many, many years to come. I mean, we're already many years on with Middle Earth, okay, so, and I think that Star Wars will also endure. So, all right, neither Professor Tolkien nor George Lucas are particularly well known for scripting romance. You know, we could think about this as, perhaps in Star Wars, romance seems to be a little more straightforward. We get a little bit more of what we typically might expect as modern moviegoers. And romance in Tolkien is extremely complicated. Probably the simplest one, at least on the surface, from what we as readers see of it, you know, is Sam and Rosie. And that may be one of the things that makes us all just kind of go, aww, whenever we talk about Sam and Rosie. Again, we get back to that ability to relate to the characters, because that feels a little more like our, you know, pedestrian everyday existence rather than that very heroic kind of romance between Aragorn and Arwen, which, of course, in Lord of the Rings was completely removed from the main narrative storyline because it was critical to it, to Aragorn's motivation as a person, as a character, but it didn't take part in the main story, so that many readers for the first time through are completely shocked when Arwen shows up and marries Aragorn at the end. It's like, wow, what is this about? Where'd that come from? Of course, if we back up to episodes 1, 2, and 3 in Star Wars, part of Anakin's momentum or motivation to move him toward the dark side was his feelings for Padme. So it was also an important motivation for him. So are these romance elements necessary to the genre? Well, I mean, yes and no. I mean, I don't know. I'm not good at genre. I said in the panel yesterday, I personally dislike the notion of genre. But certainly they are critical to the characters, and they are part of that big, overarching, mythical story. So I wanted to throw these third ones out, over this question three, quickly to you guys. I'd like to hear more from you guys. So who's the most eligible bachelor, bachelorette? Pick a universe. I don't care which one.
Shout them out.
Yell it out.
Faramir.
Oh, I'm with you.
Bilbo. Okay. Short people.
Bilbo.
Jar Jar.
Jar Jar.
No.
Miso not going there.
Okay, best drinking buddy. My answer is any dwarf.
Gimli.
Gimli belches too much. We can't be dealing with that in a drinking buddy. No,
Legolas. Don't go drinking with me then.
I go with Legolas for drinking buddy. I like someone who can hold his drink.
It comes in pints.
It comes in pints.
Best friend in a tight spot.
Or Lando, I don't know. I think Lando would have
touched. No, Lando might betray you.
I don't know. I don't know. I go with Sam, or I don't know. There's always Chewie.
Chewie.
Boy, I always wanted a drinking man.
No, I would take Gandalf. Actually, I rescind Gandalf in a tough spot.
Excellent.
Always.
Best soulmate.
R2.
Yes. Yes. True. R2 and 3PO arguably are the great romantic story in Star Wars.
That's right.
R2 and 3PO.
Yep.
Yeah, my wife and I have thought about cosplaying as them. Well, let's. We're about out of time. We don't have time for our lightning round, but I will at least show you the graphic of the great Christopher Lee, who I think we can all agree that Peter Jackson used him better than George Lucas did.
Yes.
So no lightning round questions, but maybe we'll have time later. And we did have a wish game on my computer.
I'd like to point out that Christopher Lee was defeated by little guys in both movies.
That's true.
Yes, he was.
True.
And again, if we'd had time for death matchups, here are some of the ones that we'll leave you with so you can be thinking about them. So all we'll say as we go is, may the dwarves be with you. Thank you for coming. Come on back. Come back at 8:30. It'll be a complete...